Hey, EveryTune. We are most grateful you are joining us for this mildly amusing ride. I'm your host, insert non sequitur here, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And joining me today is FlixWise co-producer. No, seriously, how is this still funny? Mr. Martin Kessler.
I don't have anything funny to say.
Yeah. Also with us is the one and only Kristen, let me quote this at you, Sales. Welcome, Sales.
Nee!
Nee! Prepare to hear a lot of that. On today's show, we have another comedy submission for the FlixWise Favorites list. Get ready for some gentle ribbing, some hijinks, and some horrendous Scottish accents, because things are about to go blissfully awry. We have only one mission for this episode, and that's to jabber on about Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Listener Jessica Gilbert has sent in her submission for why Python's 1975 debut feature is worthy of the FlixWise Favorites list. Actually meant to look that up. Is it the debut feature, or was it now for something completely different? Does that count as their first feature?
Yeah, it does.
Okay.
So this would be technically their second.
Second feature. Mm-hmm. Fine. Okay. All right, you guys, you ready? Coconuts in hand.
That's such a good audio gag, and this is a podcast.
Good day, my fair Lady P. Today I'm submitting my case for an addition to your FlixWise favorites and a film that deserves a place on the Sight and Sounds list of top 250 films, that being the 1975 Monty Python and the Holy Grail. And if you disagree, I shall have to say nee. The Pythons were a game-changing, surreal comedy troupe made up of Terry Gilliam, John Cleese, Terry Jones, Eric Idle, Graham Chapman, and Michael Palin. Though they had experienced success in their native UK with three seasons of their sketch show The Flying Circus, which was also commissioned by David Attenborough, which is kind of amazing, The Holy Grail marked their first foray into feature film with all new material and, more notably, their breakthrough to North American audiences. This is also the directorial debut of Terry Gilliam, who would go on to prove his importance in the film canon. Brief synopsis. The movie follows King Arthur, played by the straight-faced Chapman, as he recruits his Knights of the Round Table and sets off to find the Holy Grail. With him are Sir Bedivere the Wise, played by Jones, Sir Lancelot the Brave, played by Cleese, Sir Galahad the Pure, played by Palin, and Sir Robin, then not quite so brave as Lancelot, played by Eric Idle. Though its framework follows a familiar Arthurian adventure, the obstacles and characters are anything but. We see noble knights skipping along foolishly, pretending to ride horses, their squires behind them with coconuts making the horse noise. We see plague-ridden villages trying to pass off their elders for dead. But I'm happy! We have politically aware peasants. I'm being repressed! Medieval witch-hunting logic. She turned me into a newt. Well, I got better. Taunting French guards. Your mother was a hamster and your father smelt of elderberries. A stubborn black knight? It's only a flesh wound. Tim the Enchanter, the knights who say nee, and detailed conversations about the velocity of an unladen swallow. 40 years later, the Python's absurd Arthurian adventure still holds up beautifully. And I think part of the brilliance of the film was how they kind of lampooned this often galvanized tale of King Arthur with silliness. Often, the royal status means nothing to any of the characters outside their group, and they're chastised for their actions. For example, in the beginning, when he brings a coconut and he's questioned where he found the coconut, the guard asks him, "Are you suggesting coconuts migrate?" Or you have Sir Lancelot storming a wedding party, killing the guests off, and they call him out on it. They say, "You just murdered the best man!" The peasants, they're politically aware of their oppression. You have a castle full of women who huff and puff as the chase knight refuses the advances of several young, beautiful, horny women. The film was also a massive undertaking, which most of Terry Gilliam's films would prove to be. It almost didn't raise the £150,000 needed for its budget, and the only reason it did at the last minute were from contributions made by Pink Floyd, Jethro Tull, and Led Zeppelin. But necessity, it's the mother of invention, and this film is a really good example of what you can do when you're forced to think outside the box. So there's a really great joke at the beginning title cards, and the only reason it's there is because they ran out of money for better title cards. Or the coconut gag was birthed when they realized they couldn't actually afford to have horses on set. So the Holy Grail has given us countless gags and numerous quotes that still entertain modern audiences, and we also have a look at Terry Gilliam's silly, violent, but always very brilliant cutout animations. The troupe shows an impressive amount of scope. They take on several characters throughout the film, and you have musical numbers composed by Eric Idle. They're catchy, they're really cleverly choreographed. It really effectively uses a few editing techniques that are still used today in comedies. That's mainly the breaking of the comedy rule of threes by letting a gag carry on and on for an unorthodox amount of time. We see that in Family Guy, probably is the best example today. And not only is its material really outstanding quality, but what makes the film most notable is how it's able to weave together its sketch-like scenes in such an experimental way. So you're constantly being sucked into the Arthur tale and then pulled back out of it. Either you have self-referential moments, like characters turning towards a camera, or you have a shift in medium. You'll cut from live action to animation and then back. Or just plain absurdity of having modern people in medieval world and mixing up the timelines. I think a big help for this, the sound design is really, really brilliant, along with the pace of editing, so those two together are able to carry you along for this ride with really surprising fluidity. Especially considering this was 40 years ago, the editing pace holds up, like I still even think it's quick. This unique Python-esque comedy would go on to heavily influence Lorne Michaels, who founded Saturday Night Live, and we know how influential that has been on the comedy genre. The Pythons were the first example of a collective, self-contained group that had complete creative control over their material, and I think they really challenged a generation of young writers and comedians and directors to think differently about what was acceptable and what the possibilities of film were. And that, my dear, is why it deserves to be on the list. Now go on and find me a shrubbery, or I shall have to say nee again. Thanks. Take care.
Okay. Thank you, Jessica. I've had this recording in my inbox for over a year, and I sincerely apologize, Jessica, for taking so long to get to it. I don't know what's wrong with me. It's Monty Python, for goodness sakes. Somehow there's never the perfect time, but there's never a bad time to discuss the Pythons, right? Okay, so let's go around the table and talk about how we feel about Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Martin, let's start with you.
Okay. I like the film. I should probably say it's not my favorite of the Monty Python films, but I like it quite a bit. I think maybe what keeps it a little bit at a distance from me is, for a film that I think is built so much on surprising you and playing with you, like, it's become completely ingrained to the point where everyone knows every joke and every quote kind of in advance. Like, it, watching it again, it kind of, I think, spoils a little bit of the absurdity, just knowing to expect it. But I still think it's funny. There's a lot of jokes that I still laugh at. And one thing I really like is the atmosphere, actually. I was thinking, it's not quite Hard to Be a God, but I do kind of like how it captures this medieval sort of grayness and muck and fog, and even how they use the shoddiness of the low budget that they had to work with kind of to their advantage. It's sort of, you know, nothing about this feels shiny the way like some medieval epics can, that like really show off the, not quite fantasy, but the sort of chivalry or the fantastic way that some people imagine the era. Like this, it's so full of filth, you know. I like when they say, oh, you must be the king. How do you know? Because he doesn't have shit on him.
Yeah.
And all that stuff. Like, I think it's actually really, I like the direction. I like the craft. You know, you can tell that there wasn't actually that much improv, really. Like, I know they had sort of a high bar that they had to clear for each other to get something into the script. You know, they could be fairly hard on one another. And I think it shows, actually, that they didn't necessarily let in a joke unless they knew it was going to work with that specific sense of humor. So it feels like every joke more or less lands. I think it's just the sort of familiarity that puts me off a little bit now.
Mm-hmm. That's fair. Sales, What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Martin's point is that it has become so culturally saturated. And I don't know of anyone who didn't, like, watch this in high school and then, like, immediately memorize all the quotes. Like, that seems like such a permeating part of, like, being a teenager in mm-hmm. a way is, like, quote-unquote discovering Monty Python and then, like, just kind of yelling quotes from this movie or from Flying Circus, you know, yeah. around campus. I don't know if that's, like, exclusively, like, a nerd thing. I don't know. But it feels like everyone that I knew sort of went through that mm-hmm. phase. So it was interesting for me to rewatch this this week for the first time in several years. And in a way, like, it holds up in certain regards. And I think what, to Martin's point of, like, yes, you know the jokes, you know where they're coming, you recognize the scenes. But I think what does hold up is the performances. Mm-hmm. Weirdly, like, I would never think of Monty Python, as being, like, very strong performance-wise. But, I mean, obviously it is. And all the guys in the troupe are really holding it down, especially, like, we can talk about this more in depth, but I think Graham Chapman is, like, kind of the all-star of this movie.
Interesting. Yeah.
Like, it really would not work without what he's doing as King Arthur, and it's so below the radar. But I think the more you watch it, the more you realize that it's like, oh, that's the glue that's keeping this together.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for him and his sort of supercilious demeanor and just kind of, like, the way that he, like, holds his body straight up and, like, the sort of pompous, regal way that he yeah. walks, but he's totally selling it. Like, it's not like he is jokingly playing a king. Like, he is a king.
There's sort of a noble dopiness to him that I think they sort of expand on in Life of Brian. You can see why he kind of became the focal point for that film and why so much of the craziness, it's anchored by his performance, I think, in both of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And it's like, I feel like they would not, like, the Monty Python as a troupe would not have been able to tell these kinds of stories and get away with the other ancillary, more ridiculous characters if they didn't have someone of that acting caliber, like, within doing something, like, really important that actually anchors it. Like, they wouldn't have been able to tell, like, stories if they didn't have someone who could pull it off. It would all just be, like, and now for something completely different, or it would all just be, like, extended sketches.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, like, when I was rewatching it, like, there are line readings, like, certain intonations of voice, which are funny every time. Like, they did catch mm-hmm. me, and it does have that sort of fresh quality where just hearing someone say something in a certain way will always, you know, like, affect me in a way. And then you do have that kind of, like, secondary warm nostalgia when you watch it, because you remember how it made you feel in the past, or you remember good memories about it. So it's kind of hard to talk about a film like this, which I feel like so many people have such a strong nostalgia about, because mm-hmm. you can get bogged down in that. But I think it works as a standalone film, but it's enriched, obviously, by previous experiences. So I don't know. I don't think you can kind of talk about it without talking about the cultural legacy of mm-hmm. it and your own personal experiences with it.
Yeah, and that's totally fair. And I think that the cultural legacy of this film should play a part in our decision of whether or not it's worthy of canonization,
mm-hmm.
Because that is the part of the film that is most enduring. And I think that's kind of my relationship to the film as well. Like both of you guys and like a lot of our listeners, I am sure, I watched this film in high school. And it was kind of a way for, like, a lot of what is great about this movie is extraneous to the film itself, which is that it sort of fosters a community of comedy nerds, and not even comedy nerds. Like, you just find random people who are just really into Monty Python, and specifically this movie. There was really something for everyone here. Like, I couldn't, even the other two popular films, I'm sure we'll get into whether or not we think this is the best of the big three, but this one had a quotability and an accessibility that I think the other two did not, and it therefore became the sort of go-to Monty Python film, at least in the United States. I understand that in the UK, Life of Brian is much more popular, but well, I guess, yeah. Sorry, go ahead, Martin.
I just wanted to ask, like, to what you're describing about the community, I was wondering if you think maybe there's a difference between the film being a classic versus a cult classic, or can it be both? Mm. I don't know if, like, at a certain point, the film becomes too big or too culturally relevant to even be classified as that.
Right. I mean, there's certainly a cult following. It just so happens that the cult that followed it became pretty influential themselves. Like, mm-hmm. as mm-hmm. Jessica mentioned, Lorne Michaels. I don't think there's any argument that, like, the Simpsons is kind of in the part of the direct lineage of Monty Python. Like, the
yeah,
sort of,
it's pretty hard. Like, I feel like all of the comedy writers who came of age on Monty Python on this film. So when they started writing in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s, and they basically took over the contemporary American comedy scene, it's like Monty Python was what they were aspiring to be and mm-hmm. to do. So it's kind of so inescapable, the influence of this kind of comedy.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know, but I couldn't gauge, like, just how popular this movie is. It seems to me, in my own weird nerd bubble, that this transcends cult classic.
Mm-hmm. I think I would agree with that, because yeah. it's kind of like something like Rocky Horror, which did start out kind of as a legitimate community-based sort of queer weirdo punk scene, like, midnight movie thing. But, I mean, it's not 1975 anymore. Like, Rocky Horror, like, everybody watches Rocky Horror, you know, and it's been disseminated in different forms. And I think that Monty Python and the Holy Grail has been disseminated in different forms. You know, like, they did a Broadway musical that was based on it. So I think once the creators of something co-opt the popularity of it and spin it off into something else, then you can't really claim cult classic status, because they are acknowledging its cultural relevance and kind mm-hmm. of putting it into the zeitgeist mm-hmm. again.
Yeah.
And it's not like a knock against it. It's not like you're losing something if it's no longer a cult classic. But I think that really, like, when you have, like, Monty Python toys and action figures and merch and other things like that, then it's really, like, not, it doesn't belong to a cult group of people anymore. Mm-hmm. It belongs to everybody.
Right, right. And I think a large part of that is, like, geek culture has become the dominant culture.
It's taken over.
Yeah. So where this once might have been kind of, this once might have had just fringe appeal, now that the nerds have inherited the earth, I think everyone is going to hear knee and, mm-hmm. you know.
And all the guys in the troupe, like, went on to mainstream success,
mm-hmm. right.
basically. And so their careers didn't stop with Monty Python. And they, especially, like, a guy like John Cleese or Michael Palin, like, went on to more quote-unquote respectability mm-hmm. as not only as comedians or sketch comedians, but as actual actors. Mm-hmm. So I think that brings a different tenor to the work that they did when they were younger. And I think it brings a different audience to rewatch that early stuff, but I think it also changes the meaning of, like, what Monty Python is when the people in that group go on to do different things.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. To me, what really tips this off as being, like, as kind of becoming mainstream is that there are now nerds who say, well, you know, Life of Brian is really their best movie, when in fact...
Who are you talking about?
I'm not accusing anyone, but when a pop cultural work reaches a point where it is no longer, where, like, contrarians can be like, this lesser known film is actually their best work, that's probably an indication that, like, they've sold out, man, you know. And yeah.
I don't know if it's like necessarily contrarianism. Like, I think it does feel, if you watch them all together, like, it does feel like a huge step up in a lot of ways in ambition and in structure, you know, to go from one to the next. And it's not necessarily like a knock against holy grail to say, you know, they maybe prefer Life of Brian, you know.
But totally teasing you, Martin. I also prefer
today where I've been accused of just like basing my tastes off what's the edgier choice. Right.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's kind of like in a band, like if you have kind of like an early, kind of a rough early garage rock record that they kind of made themselves mm-hmm. and maybe doesn't have like a polished production, and then, you know, the band gets more resources, they become better songwriters, they get a better producer, and the album sounds kind of nicer. Mm-hmm. Like it's doing different things. Mm-hmm. Like the means of production is different and what they want to accomplish is different. So that's kind of how I see like a Holy Grail versus Life of Brian.
I mean, one thing I like about both Holy Grail and Life of Brian over Meaning of Life is the way it sort of mines history for absurdity. Like, I think so much in history is just like weird and hilarious when you sort of read about the jumps in logic and it, you know, it's exaggerated, obviously, but the, you know, there's times when they're saying, oh, she's a witch if she weighs the same as a duck and things like that, that sort of have a kind of echoes mm-hmm. of the sort of things you'd actually read about. Like, you know, I remember reading Suetonius's 12 Caesars and just like cracking up laughing reading about some of the stuff with Nero and things like that. And even the Terry Gilliam's animations, the way they look, like the sort of illustrations you might see in the margins of medieval Bibles, like you look at the real ones and they all are kind of like weird and funny and strange. You know, you have like real medieval illustrations of knights fighting giant snails or rabbits jousting. Like I think there's something sort of absurd that they pull out of history, which I really enjoy in both of those films.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we should talk about this. What is the Python brand of humor? I think Jessica talked about it a little bit, but I think maybe we can sort of pin down exactly what it means to be influenced by this style and what are they doing.
I think it's like, for me, it's always like highly, highly, highly intelligent, but sort of it's almost like post-intelligence, because it's the ability to see absurdism and the kind of like societal structures just that we create to make ourselves feel like we are doing something important, or that we've created something that differentiates us, our time, or our society versus what's come in the past or something like that. So it is really, I think it's like deeply intelligent political satire, even when the sketches are not political per mm-hmm. se, because it's always about like actually everything about us, humanity as a group, is deeply silly. And the more you look into what human beings have accomplished, the more you can see that these are just people who are floundering and don't really know what they're doing, and they're just trying to come up with something. And I think you see that even in like the more contemporary sketches that they were doing in Flying Circus, like Ministry of Silly Walks, yeah. or in and now for something completely different, the Upper Class Twit of the Year. I mean, just that kind of thing where you're just like, yeah, this is stupid. Like, let's just all be honest with each other and say that all of these distinctions that we make between classes or races or genders or anything like this, this is all just made up. Mm-hmm. Like, the only thing that exists is us, and then we make all of the rules. And so it's kind of really, like, kind of deeply humanist and kind of just like, well, we might as well laugh about it. Like, mm-hmm. to me, that is the basis or the impetus of all of their comedy.
Yes. Did you just coin post-intelligence?
I don't think so. There's absolutely no way I did.
Because that's brilliant.
I don't know how something can be like smart and dumb at the same time, but it is, and it's great, you know?
Yeah.
I love it. And like, you're right. It does sort of highlight the absurdities of life. It doesn't matter if you're searching for the Holy Grail. At the end, it's just as ridiculous and just as silly as mm-hmm. any other endeavor. So it's true.
Very true. I do want to kind of talk about maybe some of the other comedies that came out around this time, and if maybe we can draw some connections, or if this is just so completely, it's definitely possible this is a total standalone work, and the Python sense of humor is just so original to this to this time period and these five guys. But Young Frankenstein came out in 1974. And that, I think, is kind of the height of genre parody. That's sort of the pinnacle of genre parody. I don't know.
I think American genre parody.
Sure.
I think it's interesting to put those two in conversation with each other because Mel Brooks is critiquing kind of an institution of American society, which is classical Hollywood movies. Mm-hmm. And Monty Python is skewering British history. Mm-hmm. And I think Monty Python really comes from a tradition of British satire, which is not present in American society for the most part. Like, they're critiquing culture, and I think Mel Brooks is critiquing culture in a way, but he's critiquing kind of popular culture.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, I think in the audio commentaries, one of them, I forget which member of Monty Python it was, but one of them specifically says, oh, I think what Mel Brooks was doing gets close to what we were doing, but for America, I think they use that exact phrase. So that,
really?
I think that's right, yeah.
And I mean, I think it is, like, really, because it's like, Monty Python didn't come out of nowhere. Like, they came out of, like, I think, like, what guys like Spike Mulligan and Peter Sellers and stuff were doing in radio in the 50s, that kind of absurdist satire. And I think that they come out of but it's very much a British tradition. And I feel like America has a very rich comedic tradition and a tradition of satire, like, you know, Mark Twain or something. But I think it's more folksy, and it's less, I mean, like, Britain has a history of monarchy, and they have a history of a very long history of imperialism and things and all that kind of stuff, which I think really informs Monty Python and a class system. And I think American satire is different because our societal, you know,
yeah,
makeup is different.
Yeah. But we're an autonomous collective.
Oh, dear.
Exactly. I mean, I think you don't see, I mean, yeah, I think jokes about a sort of communism or communes or whatever were a little more risque in America in the 70s. I mean, we're still fighting Vietnam, so.
Yeah.
Wah, wah. Yeah. In 1975, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's true. And the sort of anti-intellectualism, or the sort of satirizing of anti-intellectualism, I think it plays very specifically to British culture. Our brand of intellectualism in the 1970s was kind of, I don't know, I'm thinking of like Norman Mailer. Mm-hmm. It's more masculine, more like, you know, just men fighting the men fighting the other man, you know.
Like, yeah, definitely. Like, it was a lot of like culture wars in a way, of kind of like the Vidal versus Buckley kind of two kind of stags going at it. Like, but even that was, I would say, a fluke in terms of popular American culture, because we don't really have a long history of valuing intellectual discourse. Like I said, like, it's more folksy. It's more like common sense, like, to go back to Thomas Paine, literally the name of his pamphlet or whatever, or somebody like Mark Twain, where it's just like a little more humble. Like, it's not, you don't want to, I think, like, British, and it's certainly like the American idea of like a British person is like, they're wearing tweed and glasses and drinking tea, and they have like discussions about things, which obviously we know is not the case, but I feel like that is an American projection of like what British culture is like.
Don't let the accents fool you.
And I think British people have the exact same idea of American, is that maybe we all like wear overalls and like are
on straw.
Exactly. And we're like eating apple pie and like talking about God or something. Yeah. Like, it's not, it's very like different in terms of just the way that we approach. And I think that Monty Python really leans in to the absurdity of British identity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that helps them play really well in America, because in some ways they are producing a version of Britishness which is acceptable to Americans, because we also kind of think that some aspects of British or British identity are funny.
Mm-hmm. It's good to know that they recognize that they're silly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, but you can see in the kind of the variation too of accents that they do, like especially on Flying Circus, you know, they are playing up, a lot of those characters are playing up poshness, or they're playing up sort of working class kind of chavvy accents. You know, like I think about like Michael Palin, like goes pretty hard into that in Holy Grail, especially in The Peasant. He's really like chewing those consonants. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, they have like different variations of that in those characters, or like Tim the Enchanter, which like, why is Tim the Enchanter Scottish? Yes. There's like no reason except that I think that accent choice is like really kind of strong and intimidating, and for some reason like connotes a certain strength or a certain kind of communion maybe with like nature. Like it's kind of like a Scottish shepherd or something, like out there among the hills. And I think that there's no reason, quote unquote, for that, but I think it connotes a certain difference, especially in relation to the characters or the accents that the knights are playing, which are kind of just, they're more straight, I would say. They're not inflected as much.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, was it Michael Palin who played the father at the wedding?
Yes.
Yes.
I think, like, in the commentary also, they were sort of breaking down, like, oh, it's this particular sort of accent, which, you know, you might associate with a merchant who's more interested in money, and, like, already setting up, you know, whether you're conscious of it or not, why, like, he might be totally disappointed by his son, or, you know, like, there's sort of jokes that, you know, you might not even be aware of, but it sort of, like you said, connotes, I guess, certain impressions of how these characters might be, or...
Yeah, definitely.
You know,
like,
gives them some quality that, you know, makes the jokes play.
Mm-hmm. Right, and I think that those are, so, like, subtle indicators of... Obviously, they're anachronistic, right? So if he's putting on sort of a more, like, working-class merchant voice, that's right. A little bit of an in-joke to the people in the UK who can identify... Mm-hmm. Where people are from or what kind of status they have in life versus how they talk, which we do in America too, but it's not, I don't think we have that amount of variety. And I think that scene in the castle that's my favorite.
Yeah, that's mine too.
That's my favorite section of the whole movie.
He even has to stop to hack the flowers. But like everything
flowers.
From the beginning, like when Eric Idle's watching guard and he just has that goofy smile to like shoot the arrow out the window with the message.
Honestly, everything about that is so good. And that's my favorite line in the movie. What, the curtains?
And just the silliness
of
the...
This is going to like devolve into us quoting.
Let's be careful.
I mean, that's always the danger of talking about comedies critically, is it sort of always kind of devolves into like quoting and describing your favorite moments. You know, that's sort of... It's hard to have like any kind of discourse that doesn't turn into that.
Just that one, though, specifically. Yeah. I think personally in my life, I have... quoted that one the most or thought of that one the most, and I just don't know why. It's so small and so stupid, like it doesn't have any import, you know. It's there are more popular ones, but I don't know why that one is so just like sticks with me so much. I think it's just because I don't know.
I mean, that whole section, I think it's especially pitched perfect from beginning to end. Everything about that one kind of works, so
Yeah. And it does have my favorite sort of visual gag or like filmic thing of working with editing, which is when Michael Palin is charging up to the castle. John Cleese is charging up to the castle.
There.
And it's just I mean, that is such a brilliant use of shot reverse shot. I mean, like it's so like talk about like the fundamentals of film editing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like that one is so satisfying because literally it's just a cut joke. Like they just cut on the joke and that's the joke.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so funny. And then like what you said when it's like off screen when the guard makes the noise, right? He's like, "Hey." Cuz you know that he's just been stabbed, but it's like that, I mean, that is a perfect visual joke. And then the little capper at the end is just that tiny little audio joke, and it is just so well calibrated.
Because we talked about last Flixboy's favorite about A Shot in the Dark, and I think like one criticism we had was that the editing was really flabby and didn't necessarily work to the the advantage of the comedic performances or a lot of the gags. Like this movie, the editing's really good. Like I think so many of the jokes feel so perfectly timed in relation to the editing. Or I like, I don't know if it's Zoot or Dingo, but like at the very end when Eric Idle leaves and she says, oh shit, like the edit to end that joke, the timing, it's perfect. And like sort of watching these, the two so close together, there are moments in the Shot in the Dark where it just didn't have that punctuation or sharpness in the editing. So I really like that going from one to the other, noticing how well the editing worked, especially.
And I think that that's one of the things in the hallmark of just kind of like a DIY approach to making a film where you don't have a lot of money and it's being made by people who are coming out of sketch comedy and improv in a way, is that the way that they think about making art is kind of all hands on deck and they use all the tools that they have. And so it's not so much to me that the editing is good. It's just they're using all of the tools that they have at their disposal in the way to make movies to contribute to the jokes. So it's like, how can we make this funnier? And if it's in a performance or if it's in animation or costuming or if it's editing, like, let's just use it. And everything is going to make the jokes work. That's the only goal. And that's why it's so it works so well.
I think to look at what could have been problems and turn them into creative solutions, like with the opening credits, you know, if you don't have money to do fancy credits, you make a joke out of it, making fun of the Bergman films or whatever. Or there are so many instances, like the coconuts, that's a great example, because, you know, if you don't have money for horses all throughout the film, you make a joke out of it. It's sort of constantly turning your limitations into strengths or jokes. I like that quite a bit about this film.
Yeah, but it even contributes to the narrative construction of the film, because you're introduced to King Arthur and then he meets Terry Jones's knight, and then it basically just cuts to the book of the film to introduce the rest of the knights, because it's like, I don't think they had the budget or the time to, or they maybe didn't even know how to get the other knights into the story. So basically all they do is just cut and say like, oh, there are these other knights, and then when you cut back from the book of the story, they're all there together, and then they just start the rest of the narrative. So it's really just like, it doesn't matter what traditional narrative structures are. Like, we just need to get these people here. Like, we need to start the movie. And then they did. They were like, whatever we can do to get this done, we're doing it. Yeah. Or, you know, in the way that they're all playing multiple roles, right? So sometimes not all of the knights are there, and so they just put their their helmets down or whatever and pretend that, you know, it's John Cleese when John Cleese is playing another character. I mean, it's, you know, you do what you have to do, but it does add an extra layer of humor knowing that they were really shorthanded, and sometimes the people who are in the frame are not supposed to are not there, or sometimes there are extra characters there that have not been introduced, and it's just kind of like, you know what, just go with it.
So Martin, as we've touched on, there are a couple other Python films, and you said this one is actually not your favorite. Can you tell us why you prefer Life of Brian?
I think a lot of it comes down to the structuring being like a little bit more narrative focused, which sort of sounds weird for something that's like a bunch of sketches loosely tied together. But I find, like, aside from the humor, just maybe a little bit more of a emotional satisfaction in Life of Brian by the end. You know, not that the ending of Holy Grail isn't satisfying. I think it's fantastic. But I do kind of, I think of Holy Grail, like, in terms of individual skits or jokes or moments. But I think Life of Brian, it's something that I enjoy watching as a film as a whole from beginning to end. You know, it's something that works better for me as a film in its entirety than maybe thinking of, like, individual scenes or moments. That is fair. And the meaning of life. It's funny, but it's also a film I find like maybe off-putting in a good way, but like I get like nauseous watching that film. So
yeah. I think Mr. Creosote is a deal breaker for a lot of people. I really find it like a litmus test for a lot of people. But yeah,
when Terry Gilliam just like unzips and walks out of his skin, I always like do like a weird like loop in my stomach for some reason. It's like ugh. There's a few things that are just like disturbing about that film.
Mm. No, that movie, it's still revolting.
Right.
At every step. And actually, that was the first Python movie I saw, was Meaning of Life. That is not a good place to start.
No, because it's really, I mean, that's like, again, to use the band metaphor, like, that's a really late, dark, that's like after the band has, like, seen some shit, you know what I'm saying? And then they, like, make an album that's really dark, and it kind of pisses off their fan base, and they're just like, yeah, fuck you. Like, that's kind of, like, what I think Meaning of Life is.
Yeah. No, I think that's a perfect analogy. Yeah.
Like, Life of Brian, like, I would have said it's maybe more of a, you know, critique of religion and zealotry and things like that, but just talking in this conversation now, like, you are having me... I am thinking more about how Holy Grail does play on the ideas of class. And so, like, you know, maybe there's more of a critique going on than I think, than I thought, you know.
Yeah, I think I had the similar reaction. Yeah. Now, after this discussion, I'm starting to realize, you know, Holy Grail is critiquing a lot of different things. It's just not as like they don't set their sights on one particular institution.
I feel like it's not as pointed because the other stuff has not been stripped away to the extent that it is in Life of Brian. Like, there's so much silliness and there's so many different ideas going on that you may be, you know, that the political stuff may sort of get lost in the shuffle a little bit, but it is there. So if you choose to like pick that up as what you take away from the film, you definitely can.
I actually kind of want to go back and watch it now after this conversation and sort of think maybe a little bit more about the politics.
I mean, I think the example though is like the knight rampaging into the wedding party and killing all the peasants.
Yeah,
I mean that's a demonstration. Yeah, not only is that hilarious, but it's a very clear demonstration of privilege kind of the vaunted status of the knights in the culture, and that he just is like, sorry. And then he just gets out of there.
Yeah. And I love, it's a brilliant satire about British politeness.
Yes.
You know? Apologies.
Yeah. And then you have the father who's only interested in the land holdings.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's all funny, but, you know, I think this works as, or my metric for comedy would be just be in relation to this film, is just, is the comedy being served? Is the narrative focused towards jokes, towards humor? Like, because there are some comedies that are, I would say that they're comedies, but they're not funny per se because they're not structured around joke structure. Mm-hmm. There are narratives with humorous characters, or they're narratives with characters who get into humorous situations or have occasional witty lines of dialogue. And that's fine. That's just a different kind of comedy. To me, Holy Grail is a lot of jokes packed into a narrative, and the narrative serves the jokes, not vice versa. Mm-hmm. And like we were saying before, all of the weapons in their arsenal are focused towards, is this funny? Can we make this funnier? And the variety of the different kinds of humor in this movie is, to me, like the true test of like what is funny. And I think about that in terms of television shows too, something like 30 Rock, which is, everything is geared towards the joke. The characters are real, quote unquote, but how do we make that funny? Mm-hmm. And it's a joke structure, and that's always the underlying thing, is this is going to be a funny show. How do we do that?
Yeah.
Your point about like how varied the jokes are, like I think that probably is one reason why it's so popular, is it's not just slapstick, or it's not just a dry absurdity. Like, it's a great kind of combination of different types of jokes that I think all sort of hit in their own ways. And there's such a wide variety of techniques, filmic techniques or performance techniques to achieve them, that I think it's really impressive on that level. Like, we talked a little bit about that approach, I guess, when we were talking about Airplane. It's sort of, you know, often there are multiple things that are funny on different levels going on all at once, you know, it's...
Yeah, and I think that that's why it works. I mean, because we haven't even talked about, like, the musical aspects of it, but there are there are song and dance aspects which are serving
as... Musical comedy, yeah.
Yeah, and animation, and, and you know, and within the characters of the knights themselves, they have different kind of spheres of humor because the jokes about the knights are different. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and so cutting back between those stories really helps to balance the kind of jokes that you're getting, because what's funny about Sir Robin is not what's funny about Sir Galahad, right, and vice versa.
All right, I think that's a good place to ask the final question. Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Should we put it in the list? Martin, let's start with you.
I think so. It's got my vote. I think between having this conversation and rewatching it, I can get behind the idea of Monty Python as a comedy classic, and you know, even one of the greatest films ever made. I totally buy that. So
okay, this one over, as far as cultural significance, this one over Life of Brian.
Maybe in terms of cultural significance, yeah. Like I think even though I might prefer one film over the other, it's hard to argue that Life of Brian's had the sort of cultural impact that Holy Grail has, even though I think the cultural critique and the controversy and everything around it at the time is very interesting. Like, I think it's hard to argue that just when people think Monty Python, Holy Grail is maybe the first thing that comes to most people's minds.
Mm-hmm. At least in this country.
At least in that country where you don't have a queen, so.
Yeah. Yeah. Kristen, how about you?
Yeah, absolutely. Totally comfortable.
All right. Nee! I had to. Nee! And that's the way we frame it. Flicks-wise, that is. Listeners, have you ever been bitten by a moose? Come regale us with your story on our website, flickswise.com, or you can tell us your tragic tale on facebook.com/flickswise. And if you would like to join us in our epic quest to watch all 250 movies on the Sight & Sound Critics Poll, you should probably follow me on Twitter. The handle is @FlixWise. But wait, there's a test. If you are indeed fit enough to make this grand adventure, the first leg of this journey must be to iTunes. There, you must subscribe, rate us, and leave us a nice comment. Then we can proceed to Camelot, and it'll enable others to join us in our quest. And we've thrown this out long enough. Okay. And to my glorious panelists, co-panelists, fellow panelists, fellow travelers. That's another thing, actually.
Yeah. That's more communism.
Yeah. Kristen, Martin, thank you both for joining me at this round table.
Thank you.
All right.
Now we see the violence inherent in the system.
Yes. All right.
Strange and women lying in pods distributing swords is no basis for a system of government.
Some moist bint.
Help, help, I'm being repressed.
We're knights of the round table. We dance where we're able. We do routines to call a scene to footwork impeccable. We dine well here in Camelot. We eat ham and jam and spam a lot. To the round table, our shows are for the table. So many times we're given blind, but I'm quite unsinable. We're off the mad in Camelot, we sing from the diaphragm.
I have to push the pram along.
No, on second thoughts, let's not go to Camelot. It is a silly place.
Right.